Hello, it is me, Randy, again, and I am going to read for you. I've decided to do something fun and interesting. When I read a book that comes from Amazon, when that's where I find like a sample of text and I think it sounds interesting, and I read that to you, I am going to tell you the name of it and the author so you can go and pick it up if you're interested in what you hear. I will not necessarily start at the beginning, as usual, and I will not necessarily finish at the end of the sample. I will read as much as feels like fun, and then I will stop. So anyway, tonight I am going to read for you How to Defend Your Lair by Keith Amann. It's A-M-M-A-N-N, and it's on Saga Press. It's copyright 2022, so it's a new thing. And it's got a little flavor text at the beginning. It says, "It may be said that I fear too much. Surely, considering the state we stand in, I think it less dangerous to fear too much than too little." And that's a quote by Sir Francis Walsingham. There are a number of chapters to this book. I'm not going to read the whole thing. You can go and see that yourself on Amazon if you like. And this is the beginning of chapter one, Principles of Defense. So you've decided to build yourself a lair. The good news is that defense is easier, cheaper, and less inherently risky than offense. If you play your cards right, you enjoy a number of advantages: freedom of movement within your own territory, detailed knowledge of the location, the ability to set up defenses however and wherever you wish, and at least as much time to prepare as your would-be attacker, if not significantly more. The bad news is that nothing is unlimited, least of all cost, time, and your own intelligence. No matter how much circumstances favor you, you still have to work within constraints. One of these constraints is the impossibility of protecting yourself against every threat. You have to play the odds. The typical dungeon master is accustomed to drawing a map, populating it with creatures, and lastly, deciding what treasure to place in each location. Instead, I'm going to suggest that you start by thinking about the things you intend your lair to protect. Treasure, yes, but other assets as well. Next, figure out how much help you have protecting it. Then, and only then, draw your map. Because when it comes to planning effective security arrangements, you have to know what assets you're trying to protect. And you have to know which of those assets are most important. Designing a lair, or other defended location, is an exercise in risk management. You can't eliminate all risk. What you can do is identify particular risks, determine the relative significance of those risks, and thereby decide where to focus your defensive efforts. The more critical, sensitive, or vulnerable an asset, that is, someone or something you're trying to protect, the more it should figure into your security strategy. If you have more resources, you can prepare for more contingencies. If you have fewer resources, you have to focus on what's most important and be willing to let the other things go, or at least leave the responsibility of protecting them up to others. As an illustration, in the movie Seven Samurai, a group of vagrant samurai take on the job of defending a farming village against bandits who raided it after each year's harvest. The local terrain works in their favor, with one exception. Three houses and a mill lie outside the village proper, on open land across a creek. The creek is a natural moat that can be improved further with a palisade fence. Beyond the creek, however, the samurai have no such advantage. The land is flat and open, with no cover for the defenders, a circumstance that favors the mounted, fast-moving bandits. To the samurai, the conclusion is obvious. The outlying houses and the mill must be evacuated and abandoned. They're not worth the effort of defending them. While they're highly vulnerable, they're not critical, nor not compared with the village proper, the collected harvest, or the villagers' lives. Assets. Assets generally fall into three categories: physical assets, information, and people. You can think of these as the three L's: loot, lore, and lives. You may not assign equal value to all the loot in your lair, or all the lore, or bluntly, all the lives. Also, not everything you're trying to protect necessarily possesses the same kind of value. How do you determine what's most critical when it's not intuitively obvious? Here's one method, which I use elsewhere in this book. To begin with, make a list of all your assets. Next, rate the value of each one according to six measurements: intrinsic, monetary, economic, operational, regulatory, and intangible. Common practice is to use a scale from 1, negligible, to 5, vital. But in this book, I use a scale that runs from 0 to 4 instead. These ratings are qualitative and relative. They don't have to be perfectly quantified. Total these six ratings up to determine an asset's overall value. Intrinsic value needs no justification. A thing with intrinsic value is valuable simply because it exists. Loot is generally considered to have no intrinsic value, except by dragons, which have a wholly different perspective on the matter. Scholars, sages, spies, and members of esoteric societies view lore as having intrinsic value, but most other creatures don't. Life, on the other hand, is the quintessential example of something that's considered intrinsically valuable, even though it may not possess the other kind of values. That being said, your alignment may influence your estimation of this value. Good creatures, generally speaking, consider lives to have equal intrinsic value. Neutral creatures agree that lives are intrinsically valuable, but they tend to assess this value unequally based on relative status and social proximity. Evil creatures may or may not agree that life has intrinsic value at all. Some may consider only certain lives to have intrinsic value, and not others. Unaligned creatures assign intrinsic value to lives within their own social units, but not outside them. Monetary value is a straightforward measure of how much money something can be sold for or how much it costs to replace. Creatures that don't use currency for trade don't assign monetary value to anything. Economic value is a cousin of monetary value, with a couple of key differences. First, it doesn't depend on currency. Even in a society that doesn't use money, something might still be tradable for goods, services, or knowledge. Second, it can refer to how much wealth something has the potential to generate over the long term, a future monetary value greater than the present monetary value. A productive mine, for instance, is worth more than the land it occupies. Creatures that don't engage in trade at all, don't make investments for future benefits, don't assign economic value. Operational value refers to how necessary something is to whatever activity you're engaged in. Guards need weapons, musicians need instruments, artisans and thieves need tools, scribes need paper and ink, alchemists need reagents and laboratory equipment. These things have a special kind of value to those who use them. To others, it's likely that the only value is monetary. However, lives can have operational value as well. The lives of workers, for instance, have operational value to their employers, without detracting from the intrinsic value they also possess. Creatures that engage in no activity beyond surviving don't assign operational value. Regulatory value depends on the existence of the legal system. It measures how necessary something is to compliance with the law. Feudal vassals, for instance, are required to keep records of their land's agricultural output to show to their lieges. Guilds keep characters that document their right to local monopolies on their crafts. Providers of certain services may need to hold licenses to practice. Creatures that don't exist within systems of law don't assign regulatory value. Intangible value, in the case of loot, typically reflects sentimental attachment. Your collection of sad-eyed kitten figurines has no intrinsic monetary, economic, operational, or regulatory value, but it may be so precious to you that you consider it worth defending nonetheless. Certain antique items may also have intangible value because they hark back to a significant era in history or were once owned by an exceptionally distinguished personage. In the case of lore, intangible value most often reflects the benefit of keeping information under wraps. You may possess specialized knowledge, a unique pottery firing technique, the forms of a powerful figure fighting style, a spell formula, a blend of herbs and spices that elevates your reputation as a practitioner in your field. If it exists in written form, it becomes a sensitive asset that you wouldn't want to fall into anyone else's hands. You may also possess secret correspondences whose contents would tarnish your name or taint your relationships, or those of others, if someone else got their mitts on it. Blackmail material, in other words. Alternatively, the intangible value of lore may lie in its significance to you, as in the case of a chronicle of your family's history or a journal of meditations by someone you admire. In the case of lives, intangible value reflects special, irreplaceable relationships. All lives may have equal intrinsic value, but your children's lives have intangible value above and beyond that to you. Even creatures with minimal sentience may assign intangible value to things, as anyone who's seen a dog carry around a favorite stick can attest. Finally, in most instances, the value of any assets that can't be neatly categorized under the three L's, such as privacy, authority, or psychological equilibrium, is primarily intangible. Of course, what an asset is worth to you isn't necessarily what it's worth to someone else. Chances are, a group of adventurers isn't going to come after your sad-eyed kitten figurine collection, but they may be very keen to divest you of some loot or lore of which they placed high monetary or operational value. Therefore, when you're assessing what kinds of threats you need to protect against, you have to be able to look at the situation through your enemy's eyes. Even as you prioritize your security arrangements, according to the values you place on your assets, how much time and money you subsequently decide how to spend on protecting them should be, in a large part, a function of how badly other people want them, lest you ever spend on protecting something you're not really at risk of losing, or underspend on protecting something whose value to others you've underestimated. A security arrangement that considers only the point of view of the owner in the lair is flawed and weak. Once you've totaled up the overall value of all your assets, arrange them in descending order. Then, for each asset, starting with the one that's most valuable and working your way down until you run out of resources, ask yourself these questions. Whom or what am I protecting it against? Rivals, looters, hired thieves, enemy kingdoms, opposing factions, parties of adventurer heroes? PCs aren't always, that means player characters, aren't the only threat. Sometimes they aren't even the threat you have the most reason to worry about. How vulnerable is it? Can it be kept under lock and key, or does it need to stay out in the open for some reason? Will there be times or situations when it's more vulnerable than it is now? Does it need to be taken out on a certain schedule? Will it ever need to be transported somewhere else? Have my activities drawn extraordinary scrutiny lately? What happens if I lose it? Would that be an oh-well situation, or would it disrupt my activities significantly? Is it something too dangerous to allow out of my own hands? Would it cause a scandal? Do I still owe money on it? Would I grieve the loss? How thoroughly do I want to protect it? What arrangements are appropriate? What are my limits? In most cases, you want to place the strongest protections on the assets you value the most highly, but not always. Sometimes the desirability of a particular item to thieves will warrant stronger protections. Sometimes, an item may be worth a great deal to you, but not so much to anyone else, in which case, you can devote fewer resources to its defense, leaving you more to apply elsewhere. For each adversary you identify, consider how that adversary is likely to come after your assets. Will visible security measures deter them or encourage them? Are they most likely to come at you head-on, blockade you, try to break in or sneak in, or gain assistance from a disloyal insider? What can they learn about your defenses by spying on you? The more you can accurately predict, the better off you are. Because of how we assess different kinds of value, we might place a total value on a material object or an item of lore higher than we place on our own lives. Does that mean we'll die to protect it? Sometimes, but not always. Nor does it necessarily mean we care about that asset more than we care about our survival. What it does mean is it will go to greater lengths and incur greater expense to protect that loot or lore than we will protect ourselves alone. Suppose, for example, that you owe a $150,000 diamond necklace. You might decide that protecting it requires you to spend $1,250 to install a wall safe, even if you don't spend any money at all on protecting yourself. When push comes to shove, we'll still try to save our own skins, but maybe we'll take our most precious loot or lore with us when we flee, or maybe we'll leave it locked away or defended by mundane or magical barriers or traps. The point is, we try to ensure that it is still protected, even if we can't risk our own necks to protect it. The next section goes on and changes the format a little bit, so I'm going to stop there. The hardcover version of this book is $19.69. The Kindle version is $14.99. And this would be really good for anyone who's a dungeon master or just anybody who's like, I don't know, artsy fartsy and likes to come up with scenarios for things. Or if you're like a novelist and you're trying to come up with an idea for, you know, how to design your monsters fighting or something. It actually really sounds like kind of a fun book. I found this, it was recommended to me because I have a lot of D&D books on my wish list, like the actual novels and stuff. And I've actually purchased the Player's Handbook and several other things from Amazon. So that's why that was recommended to me. I would actually read it just out of curiosity to see what the author has to say, because it sounds kind of fun so far. So what else can I tell you about? I've got a few minutes to fill. I want to hit exactly 20 minutes with as many of these as I can. We are in the middle of moving. We are moving from Cincinnati to north of Columbus, and it's about a 2-hour drive. So we are packing up our stuff and moving it all in a car, first of all, which, okay, today was our third car trip with our stuff in it. We don't have a lot of furniture. We're living with the guy I was dating. So it's been a few car trips so far. And while we were up there today, this was, I guess, the third. So, Jesus, I don't know if you can hear the fireworks that someone is setting off outside, but they are so loud. That one scared me a little. Anyway, so we drove up there and there was a Pride Festival happening today. The first Pride Festival, I didn't mention in the podcast at all, but it was pretty significant. It was fun. It was in Hamilton, Ohio. And this weekend we went to the one in Marysville, Ohio, which is not my hometown, but it's a town that I live around and I actually really like it there. And the people are pretty chill. And I like that they now have a witch store, a witchy store in the on the main drag. And they're kind of becoming like a cool little town anyway. So we ate at the Mexican restaurant that's just on the main intersection there, and then we walked around, went to the witchy store, and then, which I don't know the name of, or I would say it, and then we went down to the home furnishing store where I found a cute little needle felting kit. I used to do needle felting, and then I kind of gave it up because it was annoying because I kept poking my fingers. I think that was the main reason. And then, like, I just couldn't get any results that I felt were attractive, so I gave it up for a while. And I do this. I cycle between artistic things. I'll knit for a while, and then I'll crochet for a while, and then I'll paint for a while, and then I'll try to write for a while. And right now, I'm going back to needle felting for a little while. I found this adorable little kit in the home store there that I'm going to work on maybe a little bit tonight. I don't know if I want to open it up. Anyway, we're moving. That was the main point of my story. And we went to the Pride Festival back there, and it was twice as big as the last time I went there. The last time I went to it was 2 years ago. Last year, I don't remember what happened. Just something with travel, I'm sure. And so it was all day long, and it was really nice. It started at 3 p.m., which was different. Usually they start earlier than that. And it was 2 days. They expanded it to 2 days, which is really exciting. I'm glad that it's growing. And it was really nice to see a whole lot of really supportive, enthusiastic people. Was pretty happy about that. And what else did we do? And then on the way back, I felt sick multiple times because I have celiac. I don't want to mention that in everyone, but I kind of feel like I have to in case someone's listening for the first time. They're like, what's wrong with you? Anyway. Had a celiac yuck and had to pull over 3 times on the 2 hours home. And what's happening next is, hey, don't chew the wire. My puppy's chewing my wire from my headphones. He's saying, wrap it up, sis. You got 1 minute left. What was I going to say? We were driving back and dot, dot, dot. Oh, I was talking about the rest of the plan. We're going up there with another load of stuff. This will be the fourth trip on Wednesday. And then we are helping my mom fix her brakes on a truck because she was like, let's just pick up the rest of your stuff in my truck that doesn't have good brakes. And I was like, nope, not happening. So we're helping her fix her brakes, and then we're going to come down here and get a couple pieces of furniture. Like I said, we don't have very much. It's going to fit in the back of a pickup truck. So, and then I've got like a few other very small things, and that's it. And then we're moved back to north of Columbus. So we're already adjusting our jobs to that area and everything, so that'll be fun. Oh, I'm almost out of time. Thanks for listening. You can get a hold of me at hiddeninthesnow@gmail.com, and I will see you next time. Bye-bye.